Welcome to this week's Two Men in the Middle. This is where two middle-aged guys from the Midwest get together and talk politics. I called you middle-aged again, Brandon. I'm sorry.
I'm not middle-aged yet.
This is where one middle-aged guy and one younger guy get together and talk about politics. I'm the middle-aged guy, Craig Huey.
I'm Brandon Koenig.
You're the non-middle-aged guy.
Yes.
So this week, I mean, last week was such a whirlwind. Last week had some thoughts, so some points where you just had to kind of pause and say, I got to catch my breath. I don't know what's happening here. And we were able to put together a fairly coherent kind of recap of some of the major events of the week. Right when you think, well, maybe this will slow down, maybe we'll struggle for some more topics, here comes this week, and once again, it's one of a dozen things we can choose to talk about.
Well, yeah, we didn't even really have enough time to digest what happened with Summitgate last week, and we've already moved on to, you know, so many other things.
So let's talk. Let's start first with when we were picking topics. One has to be Michael Cohen and this tape, and kind of where this flip flop he's made, gone from "I'll take a bullet for the president" to now he is clearly kind of cooperating with Mueller. He's rubbing elbows with Michael Avenatti, Stormy Daniels'
attorney.
He's all over Twitter with Tom Arnold. I mean, he went from the Ray Donovan "I'm your guy, I'll take a bullet" to "I'm keeping my ass out of jail" in literally like 4 weeks.
Yeah, 180 degree flip.
And have you heard, I heard the tape today. I kind of hard to figure out what exactly that tape means. I get it. They're talking about cash. And I think that the president's side's already come out and said, yes, they're talking about a payment to Karen McDougal, this Playmate model. That's already, we're past that.
Right. I mean, this has no impact on the bigger and broader issues when it involving Russia and, you know, what may or may not have happened. But it points to the president's credibility, and it points to his trustworthiness. And so we now know that he lied. I mean, really just, you know, lied about, you know, his involvement with this, you know, payment scheme. And so really that's, I think, what we take out of this, that, you know, Cohen is showing us that president lied. And the question is, if he's willing to lie about something like this, what is he not willing to lie about? I mean, you lose trust, it's hard to gain that back.
Well, this is just part of that drip, drip, drip of just more, more, more. I saw some polling, or I heard some polling on the way over. NPR had a poll where the delta with women's approval and disapproval across the board with him is like 45 points. So I would think this is just more of that evidence, especially toward female voters, that everything you suspected and everything you kind of strongly, all the evidence that you kind of strongly knew this was Donald Trump, it's just, it's all true. And if this one's true, isn't Stormy true? And if these two are true, aren't the 16 to 19 women that accused him of some sort of sexual misconduct, isn't that true too?
Right. I mean, if he's willing to feign ignorance about one of these cases with one of these women, I mean, isn't he willing to do it with the rest? I mean, and we know there's a string of them.
So as a Dem, this is where I struggle with this. And this is where I struggled during the campaign. Part of the reasons why I think that we've talked about the 53% of college-educated white women that just could not vote for Hillary. They just could not pull the lever. And that was the third rail that a lot of people didn't see coming in what voted for Trump. I think a lot of that gets back to, especially now in the Me Too movement, as a Democrat, we've never gone back and kind of reconciled what Bill Clinton is and how a lot of this applies to him too. And when Trump trotted out the women that had accused Clinton, while it was disgusting, and it was, he did it in a horrible fashion.
Oh, it was a diversion. He was diverting attention from his own
problems. But it also put right in your face, hey guys, your Democratic liberal hero, one of your, I'll say this, I know you'll make a bad face at me, you guys is Reagan, you know, the most successful Democratic president. Brandon wants to throw up right now if you can't see him. The most Democratic successful president in kind of a modern era, you know, he's not, there's really no difference between him and Trump in the way that he's acted with women. And
right.
That hurt my soul, saying that.
He took advantage of the circumstances. Well, and I think you can say that and definitely criticize him for that. I still recognize that he was successful, which I do. You know, Clinton was the most successful Democrat, as you mentioned. He was the triangulator because he was able to get so much done and to really kind of maneuver, you know, both the left and the right. But you have to recognize, I mean, that part of his past was, you know, back then, you know, those women who accused him, they were scorned and, I mean, criticized and reviled. Yeah. And I don't see that that would happen today based on where we are now as a country. There's no way that that would have been handled the way it was back then, if, you know, in 2018.
That was so weird that part of that is, well, how can you take this attitude towards Trump that you have when Clinton is sitting here basically accused of the exact same thing. And as Democrats and as Hillary's campaign never came up with an answer for that.
Right.
It was one of those kind of stark reminders that, hey, this is something that as Democrats, we really need to close this chapter. Number one, we shouldn't have it to keep going back to the well with Clinton over and over and over again. And now in the Me Too movement that we are, his ability to connect, his ability to be that forward facing statesman for the Democratic Party just isn't there.
It's true. Yeah, it's not there at all. And I think that, you know, the women that voted for Trump, many of those suburban women were, you know, the ultimate swing voters. You know, they were the ones on the margins who I think with a different candidate on the Democratic side could have been persuaded to easily move over. So I think that will resonate with them. I do think, though, that the Democratic Party still cannot be their overlying message. That is not the message that resonates. I think it's still, you have to get back to competence and ethics in government. And I think because that ties into everything. I mean, there's so many examples you can play into in terms of government not working as it should.
Yeah.
On, you know, the number of cabinet secretaries that have ethical dilemmas, facing scandal, that have been forced out. I mean, competence and ethics in government, both domestically and internationally. I mean, that's really the issue, I think, that resonates.
How I guess, charming is it when, remember when Romney said binders of women in a debate and everybody got up in arms? Doesn't that seem kind of, you know, quaint at this point?
Oh, absolutely. Completely blown out of proportion back when it happened. I mean, it was an answer to a question. And he was basically saying, yes, there's many women that I'm considering and they're, you know, and the consideration set, period.
He's Mitt Romney of a lot of things, a sexual harasser. No. I don't think that's going to stick.
And he never had a history of discriminating against women in government or anything like that. So it just doesn't
work. I've said it before and I'll say it again. I'd give $10,000 of my own money if Mitt Romney could be president right now. Not only through 2020, let him win again. I mean, Mitt Romney is the type of Republican that a lot of us on the Democratic side could live with if he were president at this point.
Right, because I think, you know, despite ideology, he's competent, he's ethical. There's no question about he's decent. Yeah. And you know, and that's, you look back and it's amazing how far along we've come. You know, to the point where, you know, somebody like him seems so far removed from where we are on the national stage.
It doesn't even seem like 20 years ago.
Yeah.
And he's going to be a senator. How does Mitt Romney fit into the whatever iteration of this Republican Party right now?
Well, I mean, I cannot be more ecstatic that he's joining the Senate because I think the Senate needs more independent voices and voices that will challenge the president. I mean, they don't have that many of those, particularly in his own party. And we're losing people like that, like Jeff Flake. So we need to pick those voices up wherever we can. And Mitt Romney is one of those. I think he is going to have a seat of influence like nobody else, and not just as a senator from Utah, but because of former presidential candidate, his background. And so he will have credibility that maybe another senator may not have when he challenges the president.
So Cohn comes out, if I've got the facts of the story straight, they raid his office, they confiscate a bunch of material. There's now, I think, 12 audio tapes that they said were part of what that confiscation of evidence is. Some of them are between Cohn and Trump. Some are between Cohn and somebody else talking about Trump. This is the first tape that comes out. this is, to me, this is all baked in the cake. I mean, no person who voted for Trump or supports Trump or didn't vote for Trump or thinks Trump is the worst president in the United States history, this doesn't move the needle, this first tape, in any way, shape, or form.
No. I mean, it's just a validation of what many of us already thought, right? That there was a cover-up.
Absolutely.
There were payments made. They intended to keep this quiet. And yes, the president knew about it, even though he claims, you know, to have been ignorant of it. That's all we learned. There's nothing earth-shattering, groundbreaking that's going to come
there's
from
there's
it.
No illegal activity here.
Right.
Ethics and morals, that's just up to whomever hears it. The one thing I'm really learning about this is you should never hire Rudy Giuliani as your lawyer. I mean, he's arguing now about, because did he pay for cash or check? Does that invalidate? This is part of the White House and Sarah Huckabee Sanders months ago saying the president knows absolutely nothing about this. This is yet another thing they're going to have to walk back and spin on. What do you think is happening, or what is the long game of Michael Cohen's involvement now with being, I'm going to call him a cooperating witness. I don't think there's any other way to phrase him at this point. How does this impact, you think, Trump's thought process moving forward?
Well, I think that, I mean, he didn't have a strategy other than to deflect. I mean, Rudy Giuliani's role was to deflect, divert, and he did that not very well, but, you know, he would throw up roadblocks.
Giuliani is an illegal mind. He's a political operative.
Yeah, I mean, he's not a legal mind. But, you know, I think the key is, you know, in looking past this, Cohen could very well have knowledge beyond what happened here, that it could come into play with the FBI investigation. And so that's where we should stay tuned, because, you know, all of this is child's play. I mean, the meat is with what he knows in these other areas. I mean, longtime president's fixer. If anybody's privy to the president's thought processes and what he actually wanted done and how he felt about all of these different matters, it would be Cohen. So I think the key takeaway is, yes, he's cooperating. Yes, he seems to no longer have that loyalty to Trump. And that just opens so many doors in terms of being able to reveal information we don't know in areas that matter much more than this.
And what's the old phrase about, you know, the quality of your character is in the company you keep, or something like that? I mean, Trump comes out and blasts Cohen for what kind of lawyer would tape their client. And the response has been, well, what type of person would hire Cohen?
Would hire him in the first place.
As a lawyer.
Yeah.
That's ridiculous. And I would think if you hired Cohen, I would just assume every conversation would be taped. Because there can't be any trust between Cohen and Trump.
Oh, no.
If you and I start some sort of business relationship and we immediately start, I'm going to say, maybe not breaking the law, but we immediately start doing things that, you know, I could get you in trouble, you could get me in trouble, and we're both of the character that we're in that business together, it just seems natural that this would be a natural...
Oh, that this would happen.
That's a natural activity.
That's the irony here, that he's acting surprised by the fact that Cohen would tape record him. Why wouldn't he? I mean, knowing what he's getting into, knowing the operation that Trump isn't, knowing the people that he hires, people
and
like Roger Stone, Paul Manafort...
He's going to screw you one day. One day is going to come when he's gonna choose him.
Plenty of examples of that. Exactly.
And I think, too, we can finally put to rest that this idea of personal loyalty, and that people will remain loyal to Trump.
They have no incentive to. If you look at his government, I mean, look at the number of people he's basically fired via Twitter and called out. I mean, and they found out.
True.
But after the public knew that they were, you know, in the crosshairs of the president. I mean, so you can't have loyalty when that's, you know, how your boss operates.
God, I've even forgotten that Tillerson got fired over Twitter. And
very
that,
unceremoniously,
that just seemed
yes.
outrageous at the time. Now that wouldn't even register.
No.
Like, oh, well, that's just how, that's just how we operate.
And that was like an eternity ago as well.
God, that was like 6 months ago, I think.
So it wasn't that long ago. It feels like a year ago.
It literally seems like 7 years that happened.
Right.
I believe there is a there in the Mueller investigation, but I do agree with folks, I understand why people say we need to wrap this up. Because again, your side every side needs to come to some conclusion about what's going to happen in this investigation.
I agree, but there's also a misunderstanding for, you know, the historical context of these investigations and how long they usually take.
We've talked about this is long,
yeah, in terms of
water and other things. I think
and there's so many different facets to this too. So there's been a steady stream of news from the Mueller team in terms of indictments made. So it's proceeding. I mean, it doesn't seem to be stalling, but there is a great impatience there. And I think that's been heightened by the fact that we're in this 24/7 environment where we're used to news happening so quickly and, you know, everything changing. What's news yesterday is no longer relevant today. And we're just, and so I think that plays into people's perceptions. But really, this isn't long at all.
Nixon resigned 26 months after Watergate started. And as we talked a couple weeks ago, I think Whitewater with Clinton went on for 6 years under Ken Starr.
Right.
God, that was awful. But Ken Starr was on the news every day.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, he
was out in front of the cameras, absolutely.
In public. You know, Watergate ended when Republicans went to Nixon and said, you're done. We can't do this. I can't imagine a scenario at this point where the Republicans now seem to be so deep into the Trump presidency, and Trump is the de facto leader of the party, what would have to happen for Republican leadership to roll up into the Oval Office and say, we can't do this. We're going to run you if you don't walk away.
Well, we have talked about this, and I think it's a waiting game. I think as soon as there is word that something big is coming down with the Mueller investigation, I think that's when you see the switch, you know, turn, and that, you know, Republicans start to change their tune.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, there's a reluctance to make any moves before that because they're focused on this fall, and they don't want to rock the boat at all with those hardcore Trump supporters that they need out at the polls, I mean, to prevent, you know, an ultimate drumming. So it's a political calculation on their part, how long they can ride this out before they can't any longer and they have to jump ship.
I'm tired of talking about Trump.
I want to bring one thing up about Trump, though. Okay.
Wrap up the Trump talk. Let's pick something else to talk about.
President Trump was in Kansas City yesterday, for those that don't know, speaking to the VFW.
He was.
You know, and if you saw his remarks or watched any of that, it was very painful. But there was one takeaway that made national news headlines, and it was the fact that he told the audience to not believe what they're seeing and what they're hearing. And it's, again, the irony there is this comes just within, I think, 24, 48 hours of learning that the White House has scrubbed any mention from the official transcripts of the Helsinki summit, where Putin basically said he was supporting Donald Trump for president and hoping that he would win the election. That's been scrubbed from the official record of that meeting, and the Kremlin scrubbed it from their records of the meeting as well. So it's interesting. We have the president basically saying, only believe me. Don't believe anything else you hear. Don't believe what you see. Believe me over what you see. But yet we are the ones who are willingly scrubbing information from official records.
Did you hear the reason why they did that? I heard it today, and it didn't quite make sense, but there was something about the timing of the interpreter, and they didn't catch something correctly.
Yeah, so I don't buy that
at
all.
So for honesty and not wanting to make a mistake, they just eliminated it.
Because this administration loves to err on the side of honesty, because they've always done that, right?
I mean, put your head between your knees and just say, it's stuff like that.
It's not credible at all.
So much. Yeah. It's like, how do you even process that?
You can't.
You just choose not to. It's like, you know what? I'm going to let that go, or else your head's going to explode. And you just try to move on. I didn't notice any. I worked all day yesterday, so I didn't. I saw a few people in the downtown area when I was leaving work that had some signs. I saw some things on Twitter about how much they had kind of quarantined off, so you really couldn't
pretty get wide area.
Close.
You couldn't
pretty,
even walk.
It was
let
pretty
alone
wide.
Drive. Yeah,
they were really discouraging or making it difficult for people to protest him here. And it was kind of a typical presidential visit for Kansas City, Midwestern city. He flies in, he gives a 2.5-3 hour speech, and he's done.
Yeah.
So he wasn't here very long.
No, he was, I mean, kind of in and out after the speech. I think he did stay and do a fundraiser for Josh Hawley, who's running for Senate against McCaskill.
What do you know about that guy?
Well, I mean, the current attorney general, I mean, he was considered kind of the favorite candidate.
He was the it guy for a while.
Right. You know, and I he still is. I think, you know, part of that polish has worn off, you know, some.
Yeah.
I think he still has the edge. I mean, Claire McCaskill is going to be in the fight of her life to retain that seat, just with the environment the way it is and with Missouri being such a solid Trump state. Yeah. But it'll be, I mean, if anybody can do it, it will be her.
Yeah, so you challenge Claire McCaskill, you better get ready, because Claire's won a couple of elections where it's like, how in the world did she pull that off?
But she had the benefit of a Todd Aiken running against her last time around. She doesn't have that quite this time.
That brilliantly, though. Right. But you're right. And to your point, the demographics and the attitude in Missouri is changing against her. It's going to be very difficult for a Dem to hold that seat.
Yeah, I agree.
But Claire McCaskill is no amateur, and if there's anybody that can pull that off, it's her. She is. I don't care if you like her or don't like her from a policy perspective. She is a hell of a politician, and she knows how to execute a campaign strategy.
Well, it was political genius the last time around. I mean, her
it was brilliant.
Campaign and PAC getting involved.
Absolutely,
you know, running pro Aiken ads. Yeah. I mean, for the Republican primary voters. Yeah,
just for folks that don't know, Todd Aiken is one of our favorite topics on the pod. Todd Aiken is the gentleman who wasn't on like Meet the Press. Or it was on a national show. A
national program, I forget which one.
He basically said, and Brandon, if I get this wrong, because the devil's in the details here.
Right.
If a woman, for example, gets pregnant and she does not want the baby, a woman's body has a way that she can shut that down and end the pregnancy herself.
Correct. If she is raped. So they were talking about, because he is against abortion, even in cases of rape or incest. And so he was justifying that by saying, even if a woman is raped and becomes pregnant as a result of rape, her body has a way of shutting that down, so to speak.
The one thing we learned is Todd Aiken knows nothing about a woman's body. He has no clue how the female anatomy works. And people just jumped all over that. Claire McCaskill jumped all over that.
Oh, yeah. And McCaskill, again, very smart. I mean, that's why she wanted him to win. I mean, she knew. I mean, he had quite a history in terms of being very rigid. And so it was only a matter of time before he was going to say something that would cause his campaign to implode, which is what happened.
Todd Aiken is a great example of, it's really all about the strength of the candidate you run.
Exactly.
And if you run a candidate like a Todd Aiken or like a Roy Moore, it doesn't matter where you run them, they can be beaten.
Absolutely.
It seems to, like, Republicans the last 10 or 15 years have really monopolized the crazy. Not saying that we don't have them, but the real kind of the first thing that wanted to leap out of my mouth is that whole kind of ultra-religious, you know, putting religion and biology together and mixing them up and coming up with something absolutely batshit crazy. Republicans seem to have kind of cornered that market. Roy Moore, as a grown man, I dated 14-year-old.
They are on the Republican side. Yeah. Yeah, that's a huge challenge for our party. And I think the rise of this fundamentalist segment of the party has happened because you've had a case where, you know, primaries and have become more closed, or in some types instances have reverted to a caucus system in many states, which, you know, is even a smaller segment of party activist loyalists who are voting on these nominees. And so many of kind of the moderate, more kind of main, you know, center of the party isn't participating until the general election. And so that's why you're seeing candidates, you've seen this play out in state house races across the country, where you've had candidates with xenophobic or white supremacist views emerge, and then their parties have to denounce them and renounce support. And so, like North Carolina, there's a state house candidate there where that happened. I mean, there's even congressional candidates. You look at Illinois, you look at Paul Ryan the guy who's, you know, pretty wacko crazy, who's the Republican nominee for his seat.
Well, since we're going down the Republican crazy rat hole, did you see that guy from Georgia this week?
Oh, yes, with Sacha Baron Cohen. Yes. Oh, gosh.
In the world? I'm not even going to take a swipe at that Republican. That guy's just crazy.
He's crazy. Now, that guy has already lost his primary. That happened before this video came out. But he resigned because the pressure was on, because he was just staying in office, until until the next swearing in. But that, I mean, it was too much. I mean, he couldn't last.
That guy had to be a show. He had to. Nobody does that. I mean, come on.
I mean, you can be tricked into some things. I mean, you can't be tricked into other things. I mean, what he did was far beyond the pale, and it just kind of revealed who he was as a person. Yeah. I mean,
that was. I tried to watch part of that, and it's like I don't even know what I'm watching here.
It was bizarre. Yeah.
And Sacha Baron Cohen is going around as a fake TV reporter.
That's
a shtick.
He does.
That's his shtick, yeah. And he's targeting Republicans. And he's mostly targeting them with Second Amendment, religious issues, immigration issues, trying to get them just to say very silly things.
Right.
And he did something with Palin where he did like a fake interview with her. And I think she didn't realize who he was. And she did some things. And is that entertaining? Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Do we need that right now? Probably.
Yeah, I don't think it really.
We could live without it.
Especially right now.
Things are too serious.
Yeah.
Things are too serious right now that we don't need a TV show stirring the pot any more than what we've got going on right now. I just don't see how that's helpful.
Well, and some of what's come out of that has just caused, you know, more alarm amongst, you know, people, including like Trent Lott, you know, making a quip about, you know, grade school kids being able to arm themselves, which is...
And they came up with some sort of scientific reason that, like, grade school kids, they remember small hand movements better than adults, so they're better shooters. And he like, oh well, yeah, that sounds, it's like, come on,
right?
Plus Sacha Baron Cohen's a pretty recognizable dude. I mean, yeah. you don't come on, you don't realize Borat is the one asking
how can
you
not know
questions.
That, yeah.
that's silly.
I do find it was funny that he tried to get Dick Cheney to say that he shot his friend on purpose at hunting accident, and of course, you know, Dick Cheney would have bite. He's
I think Dick Cheney did. Dick Cheney just said, look, I'm Dick Cheney, I'll do what I want. And somebody said, you can't do what you want. And he's like, really? Watch this. Pop. And, well, I guess I'm just walking away.
He
was VP when he did that, correct? Or was he out of office? No, he was out of office.
When was that? I think he was still VP. I think that was a hunting trip one weekend. Yeah, well, I think it was.
I think what people should have learned from that, never go hunting with a group of like 80-year-old dudes. Because somebody's going to shoot somebody.
Yeah. You get to a certain age, like your faculties start to fail, that driving, and let alone if you have a gun and you're out hunting. I don't want to be very close
to
you.
And the guy apologized to Cheney.
Right.
For like being in his line of sight or something. But now with that, your ass just shot me. That, oh my God. Dick Cheney. How is that man still alive?
I don't know how old he is now. I mean, he's got to be pretty up there in years.
Yeah, but his heart's
know.
Like 127 or something.
That pacemaker keeps going.
Let's go to tariffs.
Yeah.
No worries. Everything's cool. Trump met with the gentleman representing the EU.
Everything's solved. Yeah.
All good. Now, when asked, could you expand upon that? Just everything's cool.
Oh, we never
it's
get
all
details,
good.
Yeah.
There's no details. So Trump has this idea of basically getting rid of all tariffs, of getting rid of any trade barrier restriction. Let's everybody go to zero. All markets are open to any country. And that's what he's pushing as what his kind of end game is with this tariff war. And somehow with imposing these tariffs, he's going to force these other countries to the table to negotiate with him. I believe you'll get some movement out of Europe. I don't believe you're going to get any movement out of China. And
no.
I don't believe Canada and Mexico are going to totally tear up NAFTA and start over again.
No, they're not willing to do that. And it's not realistic to expect that every protectionist measure is going to be repealed. I mean, that would have to occur on our side as well as
Absolutely.
On theirs. And, you know, there's a lot of moving pieces here. But the idea that, okay, we're going to either have, you know, completely free trade with no impediments, or we're going to not have it at all and we're going to institute massive tariffs. I mean, that's not a stable situation. It's not stable for the markets, as we've seen.
It's not attainable.
Last. No.
And how do you deal with China with the theft of intellectual property? The China trade situation is far more complicated than with Europe.
And China's not going to bend on
they're
some
not
of gonna,
these. They don't have to.
Right.
Because part of it, again, is you're buying way more of my stuff than I'm buying of yours. And as Americans, we've developed our whole lifestyle around buying goods that were cheaply made in China. The pain points for us are way more than they are
for China. The manufacturing sector, no matter what Trump does, even in terms of massive subsidies, he's not going to be able to change the market fundamentals that drive manufacturing overseas.
Absolutely.
From a labor perspective, the cheaper labor costs, from a tax advantage.
It's a great point that you're swimming upstream against the global economy. You're not going to win.
Right.
Labor goes where labor jobs are cheap, and that is not in the United States. As a Republican, we'll just bust out $12 more billion worth of relief to you guys. That had to make you a little bit queasy when that was Trump's answer in the last 2 days of how to ease the pain that he's causing Midwestern farmers over the tariff war that started.
Incredibly. I mean, the party refrain for 8 years during the Obama administration was, you know, these bailouts, you know, corporate bailouts you know, stimulus, and that this is, you know, wreaking havoc. It's, you know, money we don't have. And here we have a president who's going to inject billions into the farm sector to attempt to correct a mistake that's of his own making in terms of what the trade policy.
Who knew how
it's Soviet style
you guys were.
Economics? You know, you screw up the economy and then you just inject massive subsubsidies to favorite industries based on political calculation.
My side is trying to coin the term democratic socialist. You guys are putting socialist practices into play in real time. And how is Trump going to decide how to dole out this extra $12 billion? First thing, too, the farming market in the United States already receives $60 billion worth of subsidies. It's one of the most subsidized industries
exactly.
out there. This is just another kind of handout because Trump knows he started the condition that's creating this. Is it small farms that get this? Is this big agribusiness? This is as close of an example of an autocratic socialist style system where arbitrarily I just allocate money to an industry that I favor and to help them along over other businesses. What do you think Harley's thinking about right now? Hey, where's our $3 billion after you help drive our quarterly and our 2018 and 19 projections into the toilet?
Well, exactly. And I wouldn't be surprised to see if there's a favored list in terms of who gets this.
Oh, because, I'm sure he's got something.
I mean, look at who has donated in the past to his campaign and see then kind of where the subsidies go. But this was sparked by massive lobbying effort, by farming, which has a big presence, and they made their voice heard.
Yeah.
But there was a lobbyist I overheard who mentioned, you know, this is a Band-Aid. I mean, this is just an attempt to, you know,
this
ease short-term
not.
Pain. It's not a long-term solution.
And farmers don't want this.
No.
Farmers want the markets opened back up. They want to sell a crop that they worked hard to make. This is
basically giving them money to cover the product that they can't sell now. To other markets. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, you can't. This is something you would see play out like in former Soviet bloc countries that are still adjusting to market based capitalism and are queasy with free markets. It isn't something you typically see in the U.S. Not on this level.
You get this. There's a thin layer of American citizenry that understand this. Most people, I mean, this is tearing at the basic economic fundamentals that we've practiced since the country was started. There's some times during the Great Depression and other things that we've subsidized and paid people not to grow. And there were some very specific economic things that have happened in the past. What I'm trying to say is this isn't new. We've done this before.
Past,
but not,
and even
not selectively like this when the president chooses to start a tariff war for no apparent reason.
And not on this scale. So even like former President George W. Bush had implemented some steel tariffs, you know, very kind of isolated to kind of assist the steel sector in Pennsylvania. But we've never had it on this scale and this stubborn, you know, reliance
on randomness either.
Yeah.
I don't.
Well, and he's calling for 25% automobile tariffs again. So that is up today.
No, that's in the EU. That all got settled today.
Oh, that's right. That was.
Nobody knows how, but that's going to be in this grand bargain that he struck with the European Union today that nobody really knows
what that means,
what's coming. And again, this is a cycle that
we've seen
repeat
before.
Ourselves.
We never see the details, and we never know how this is going to actually play out.
And I've never seen a government work a big trade deal that could be done literally in one meeting. I mean, Trump claims to get things done in a four-hour session that takes years and years and years to actually work out.
Well, just like he did with North Korea. Look, we have peace on the Korean Peninsula now. Yes. Everything's great.
I mean, we are winning at a rate that who knows, you know, who knew we were going to win this much? This week is one of those weeks that I kind of wish everything just would have stopped for the week. Could the government just shut down for a week? Could Washington go away? Could the major cable news networks just go off the air and give everybody a chance?
I would love to see a polling on that. I bet you that there's more Americans now than at any level in history that would be okay with a government shutdown.
Can we just get away from it for a while? You know, can we have 3 days, a weekend maybe, of nothing? And it started with the tweet about Iran and the all caps
Monday,
which I guess now
another provocation
has some type of an all caps tweet is how we're doing foreign policy, and it just kind of starts from it just the week started all over again with here we go.
We even have and there wasn't even time to really talk about that. We moved on as a nation to other issues so quickly from that, and that itself deserved at least like a week or two of discussion.
I think too, Iran is not North Korea.
Yeah.
You know, North Korea, there are very few options available militarily. In Iran, there's a lot more on the table. This is where, again, if you don't know who John Bolton is, and you've never Googled that guy, and you've never done 15 minutes worth of research on who John Bolton is, he has wanted to bomb Iran for decades.
Yes.
And he is going to be in Trump's ear. And this kind of...
He's as hawkish as they come in terms of defense policy.
He's also talked about bombing North Korea.
Right.
But there's just no way to do it. There's no way to do it without putting South and Seoul into harm's way. With all the military options available in Iran, I would be shocked if we don't do something in the Middle East in the next 3 or 4 months.
Well, we almost have to because we tore up the Iran nuclear deal. And so
we've backed ourselves into a corner.
There's something is going to have to give. I mean, that destabilizes the entire situation. And Iran has no incentive to work with us now that deal is off the table. So this leads in. I mean, if you're cynical, you may look at this as that this is a play to take action, military action. Well, the question is when
Pompeo
that happens.
Has already said we're up for regime change. I mean, if you guys want to do it, he did not say we will support you militarily, but he did everything except say that. And I think there's no I think most Americans would support a regime change in Iran.
Right.
I think we're all good for that. And I think we thought that was what was going to happen. And it kind of didn't come to fruition. This is where, if you're an Obama foreign policy hater, you feel this is where Obama shifted the dynamics from supporting Israel to supporting Iran and trying to build Middle East peace and a Middle East democracy through Iran instead of Israel. I don't know how much of that is true,
but
this is the common talking point.
Well, and there were a lot of mistakes made by the Obama administration in regards to foreign policy. I mean, the biggest criticism was that there was no cohesive foreign policy strategy. It was changing, and that was given credibility by the action with Syria, the red line in the sand, and then withdrawing. And so there was a lot to criticize there. And I think you have to be very cautious when it comes to democracy in the Middle East, because we've been down that road before and realize it doesn't work out how we think it's going to.
I don't think they really want democracy that much in the Middle East.
Well, and you can't just build democracy from nothing.
No.
You have to have institutions, bedrock institutions like rule of law, support for property rights, the rights of minorities and minority religions. And if you don't have that to establish Democratic footprint? I mean, democracy isn't going to be feasible.
I'm not a Middle East expert by any stretch of the imagination, but I do know when you remove the central authority, often the dictator authority that keeps all of the religious factions from fighting each other, who have hated each other for thousands of years, you could expect a free-for-all.
Yeah, and we've seen that. So it's pick your poison. You can have like a secular dictator who is secular, though, you know, respects minority rights and minority religions and keeps, you know, the country stabilized, or you could have, you know, a religious zealot who, you know, runs the country and is extremely hostile. So
in
those are usually
ways,
the two options.
The Middle East was a more stable place when Gaddafi and Saddam Hussein were running the show.
Yeah.
When you take them out and you uncork the control they have over Muslim, Sunni, Shiite. And again, I don't want to project as if I know much about that, but I do know, just like in Yugoslavia when the Soviet Union fell and the person who's acting as overseer goes away and says, okay, you're all on your own now. The first thing that a lot of groups are going to do is it's time to resume an old fight that we need to have, but we stopped because the Soviet Union took over, or Gaddafi or Hussein was iron-fisting the entire
right.
country.
Time and time again, we fail to see that these sectarian divides are as strong as they are in these countries.
They don't
go
away.
They don't, and we think they will. And we think that, if we just form a government for them and make sure that everybody's represented, that everything will be, you know, unicorns
and
rainbows.
They have no history of
they
representative
don't.
Democracy. It just doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
I get a little bit agitated when folks will say, well, you know, then we paid Iran billions of dollars with the Iranian deal. We didn't pay them billions of dollars. We unfroze their money.
Right.
There's a huge difference. If you listen to the Fox News crowd, part of the narrative they like to spin is Obama paid them billions of United States taxpayer dollars as part of the Iranian deal. That's simply not the case. We unfroze assets that were Iranian money.
Right. And that was, I think, misstated numerous times. But I do think the administration failed at communicating that. There was a lack of transparency around that. So it allowed other critics to kind of swoop in and create a narrative from one that didn't exist. And that's what you saw happen.
Done really anything foreign policy from a treaty perspective or a negotiated settlement perspective? I can't. He's torn things up. Paris Climate Accord, Iranian deal, but he's not really negotiated anything. What are your expectations as a Republican or just as an observer of Trump of what can he do and what would that look like?
Well, the only example we've seen of that attempted was North Korea and the accord with North Korea on denuclearization.
Was that actually...
Well, that wasn't a treaty.
Do you really
know
what that was?
No, I mean, it was a very broad statement. And
it was a general statement that they both signed, I guess, ish.
But see, I think that's kind of what we would expect to see from him. Yeah. I don't think we will ever see details because, you know, despite all of the rhetoric, I don't think there's a preponderance of evidence to suggest he's a good negotiator. There's no evidence of that. He is good at negotiating on generalities and being able to get people to the table. But that's not what resolves conflict.
No.
You have to have details. The devil's in the details. And if you don't have those details, conflict just drags on. It may give you a temporary talking point and a temporary win that you can go and say, I went to the table with so-and-so and we agreed, you know, generally on principles.
Isn't that the CEO approach to government? I don't care about the details. I am here to strike the framework of the grand bargain. I am here to inspire. I'm here to tell everybody what to do.
Maybe. And the CEO is the face of the company, much like the president is the face of the country.
My job is to go to Kansas City and sell what I just did and tell everybody the Korean Peninsula is safe and the EU trading partners are under control. It's you guys' job to figure out what that actually means.
Right. But if you're going to be an effective and successful CEO, you have to surround yourself with staff and empower them to make those decisions on the details and to be equipped to be successful negotiating those types of agreements, those deals, having everything run smoothly. And that's where I think Trump fails because he doesn't empower the people below him to do that and doesn't equip them with the tools to do that. And he's blindsiding them almost on a daily basis so they can't do their jobs effectively. So I think that's how he differs from a traditional CEO, where a CEO surrounds themselves with good staff that can carry out the work in terms terms of details, and they stay high level. Trump is staying high level, but he has nobody paying attention to details.
Yeah.
A good example is the separation of parents and children. There's nobody who apparently thought about how that was going to be handled in the reunification.
And he didn't listen to anybody either, because somebody had to go to him and say, we're about to step in it.
Right.
Other people have stepped in this before. There's no way out of it.
And being a good leader is knowing what you don't know and being able to listen to other advice. Being like Lincoln, who surrounded himself with a team of rivals, you know, and being able to take into all those different opinions. And that's not something that's in Trump's core philosophy. He doesn't do that.
So two Republicans this week scared the hell out of me for two totally different reasons, and both at the same event. Did you see Jeff Sessions at that Turning Point USA where he was talking with the high school kids? And they started chanting, lock her up. And he started talking about, you know, how college campuses are creating a snowflake culture.
I heard about that. I didn't quite see it, though. Yeah, I caught the news.
That's the Republican that scared the hell out of me of how in the world are you the attorney general?
Yeah.
How could you stand in front of a group of high school kids and that was the message? How could you stand in front of a group of high school kids and when they started chanting, lock her up, say, folks, sit down. Let me explain to you why we don't say that anymore. Let me explain to you the difference between a campaign and governing and why in America we don't lock up our political rivals.
Right. Being the adult in the room.
Absolutely. I mean, how could you kind of just pander to this whole, the higher education system in the United States is creating just a generation of self-absorbed snowflakes. Again, we talk about this all the time. I've worked with a ton of young people in tech. Pretty smart generation, know how to operate technology, information way better than any generation before. That was one of the things where you look at Jeff Sessions and you're just like, that's horrible.
And that's who our attorney general is. And now Trump is in a catch 22 because he appointed, you know,
he can't fire
this guy.
Now.
He can't fire him because of the investigation.
So
yeah.
Much. Then there was the Republican that I'm afraid of because how impressive she was Nikki Haley.
Right.
Nikki Haley has a really good chance to be the first female president of the United States.
I mean, she's actively being talked about as a future candidate for president.
And she, in the Trump administration, and maybe it's because she's at the UN, she's been able to carve out some space for herself where there's times she's gone up against Trump and hasn't kind of felt it.
She's hit back actually publicly against the administration in ways that others haven't and have survived, which is interesting.
If anybody doesn't think Nikki Haley is a serious, I'm going to say 2020 might be too much, but a 2024 candidate for president, go back and listen to her at the same event that Sessions makes an ass of himself and talk to me about who sounded presidential.
Right.
Who talked about, hey, kids, owning libs might be fun, but it doesn't win you the argument. And government is about persuasion and facts and making people understand your perspective and understanding them. Nikki Haley, I've always kind of sort of liked her. She really kind of came up on the radar as somebody better put a tag on her and follow her and keep an eye on her because she could really be a serious player for the Republican Party.
Well, and if Marco Rubio had gained traction, she was thought to be his first choice for VP on his ticket. So, yeah. I mean, she was being mentioned actively last time around. Could easily see that. She's likable. She is considered an adult. Check out some of her speech she gave at the 2012 RNC, really enlightening. And then she also, on the domestic level, was interesting to tie it back to local politics. Back when Kansas was engaged in the tax experiment that we had that failed and was repealed, there were lawmakers in South Carolina calling for a similar tax scheme. And she said, hey, we're not going to do that because, look, that didn't work in Kansas. We're not doing that here.
Let's
which is kind of
logic.
Remarkable because, I mean, she separated herself out from, you know, the far right of her party in that aspect. And obviously, history has shown her to be correct as far as that goes.
You and I just have a core disagreement on our perceptions of Rubio. Because to me, Nikki Haley would chew him up and spit him out. It would be, hey, Rubio, you could be my VP. But as far as running, There's no way. From my perspective, Nikki Haley is 10 times the politician that Rubio is, because every time Rubio has had a chance to grab the ring and put himself at the forefront, he has failed miserably. And the last time he did it was, well, Parkland was his last example of
student forum. Yeah.
I think you're done on the national stage at that point. And he just kind of let Trump roll over him too a little bit. So of those two, to me, Haley, just as a politician, as a presenter, as somebody that could tour the country and kind of grab some imagination in that upper Midwest, Nikki Haley would be pretty solid at that.
Oh, I agree. And in the future, I mean, she runs on her own. She's not going to play second fiddle to anybody. I mean, if you see her on a ticket, she's going to be top of the ticket.
And she's Indian, if I understand.
Yes.
She's got a great background story. Mm-hmm. I don't know where you go at her if you're a Democrat. And it's horrible that when you think of a candidate, that's the first thing you think of is how do you attack her? But I think she is somebody that she was really impressive.
Yeah. I mean, she is clearly making a name for herself and has been able to dodge all of the bullets that everybody else. But again, that kind of separates her out. I mean, she's kind of unique because she's one of the few Trump critics that was actually chosen for a spot in the administration. If you think back, there weren't that many who were not Trump loyalists. I mean, that's why Sessions is attorney general, solely because he was a Trump backer in the early stages.
He drives me nuts. As a Dib, I'm going to be so pissed if you guys elect the first female president as a Republican. Because that's ours.
I would love to see that happen.
I mean, we see ourselves as that's what we do. We're capable of making history with minority candidates. We elected the first black president. The first female is our mantle to grab, too. That's going to be a kick right in the gut if the Republicans win with the first female candidate.
I could definitely see that happening now.
And with Haley, that could happen. I mean, she's a serious player at that.
Yeah.
What else do you want to talk about? I'm kind of depressed, actually. You know, this has been
seems to be a recurring theme. You know,
that's like the third time I've said I've just depressed myself in politics. I think you go through cycles where you consume so much data and then you feel like things are disconnecting at such an alarming rate. You kind of just want to say, ugh, I just need that week of give me three positive stories this week and I'll be good with it. And it's like, well, we're probably going to bomb Iran. We're trying to put our own farmers out of business. And it's just by Tuesday, you're like, well, that's it. Three positive things isn't going
to
happen.
I know. Apparently, I have to monitor and try to find some positive stories because I was trying to listen for some and I came up with nothing. So I'm going to have to actively search out positive stories to
So you're like an
showcase.
Internet marketing person. Yeah. Can't you rig your Google alert or stuff to say, just show me anything positive. Just show me something that lets me know part of what I grew up with or believed in America is still here.
Right. Rig my Facebook news feeds.
But it's not that bad.
It isn't. Again, you have to take it into context and perspective. Yeah. And we've had dark periods in history and we've risen and been able to move past those. And we will again. I mean, the pendulum always swings back in America. And that's the faith that you always have to have because that's been something we can rely on.
There's a great book that I'm listening to right now called Suicide of the West. If you haven't read that,
I have not. Who's the author? It,
Jonah Goldberg.
Oh, yes.
Really good. And one of the basic arguments is the world is better than it's ever been. By all any measurement, any metric you want to choose, we are at the best place for humans that we've ever occupied. By violence, by war, by health, by wealth, whatever you want to choose, this is the best. And we're only really
life expectancy,
whatever metric you want to choose, we're at the best it's ever been. And we've just started really as humans understanding that each of us have basic rights and we should respect those rights and we should help each other kind of grow as humans. For most of our history, we were scratching in the dirt. eating whatever we could, and
you're engaged in perpetual conflict. You know,
absolutely. It's only really been in the last couple hundred years, and then they start making the argument about what role capitalism has played in that. We are at the infancy of what we're going to be. So one way, if you want to take the extreme long arc, is hey, it's we haven't been at this long. Trying to respect each other and understand that each of us have basic human rights. We've gotten really good at it really fast, and it's only going to get better.
Right. And I think that's why we're more upset as a society, because we have more cognition and recognition of those rights than we have in the past. Yeah. Whereas, you know, if this would have taken place, you know, 100 years ago, we might shrug and be like, yeah, you know, because we know better now, and we know that we're on this trend in the opposite direction. Yeah. So when we see things playing out like what's happening at the national level, we're even more upset by it and more angered, because it's going against the grain that we've been on. So
there's another great book, and that'll let you recommend a book. There's a book called Sapien. If you're interested in the evolution of human beings at all, God, we could do 3 hours on this. This is one of my favorite topics. There's a book called Sapien that outlines the growth and the evolution of humans as a species. Just absolutely remarkable stuff.
I'll have to check
very
that one out
fascinating
too.
And when I say read, I do all my books on audio, just because it's just the way to consume them. But if that topic holds any interest into you or any interest for you, it's a great book. It's well written, and it's a great audio book as well.
Yeah, I'll put that on my reading list. There's a book called Triumph of the City. I think it was written about 5 years ago. Also a really great book, and using a lot of data studies, author looks at the growth of these big urban population centers. Yeah. You know, we're becoming more of an urban society, you know, and less rural. And so there's been a lot of criticism of what that means, but the author looks at and it actually cites a lot of those factors you have in terms of higher life expectancy, interconnectedness, more job opportunities, the dynamic nature of cities to change and to thrive. And so he looks at it from that perspective and how it's a good thing. And then environmentally even, how cities are more conscious of waste and of recycling and sustainability. And he goes through a lot of different case examples for that. But it's a fascinating read, Triumph of the City.
It's always remember, if you're picking any time in human existence to be alive, you pick now.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. Even 40, 30, 20 years ago, you would pick right now. And just that recognition of things aren't that bad.
The access to information alone that we have now that we wouldn't have had back then.
Just thinking of growing up, because I grew up pre-internet, and trying to explain what that was like and going back to that. Once you take these huge steps forward, you can't even imagine going back and reliving. How did you get through high school with no internet, no cell phone, no smartphone, no information? It's something to think about. And the next time you think the world is falling apart,
not being able to instantaneously get an answer to an obscure question that you have at the moment. Like, I don't know how people did that.
I get so pissed when I don't get an alert. Well, my wife, when she gets an alert first, I get mad, because it's like, I should get that first. Or if the kids do something, it's like, I should know that first. All right, we're at an hour, Brandon. Got anything else we need to talk about?
I think all spent. I think we covered a lot.
Thanks, man.
Thanks.